today on Building the Open Metaverse.
Photoreal is really, really important to, you know, the customers that we're going to, but if we can do stuff faster, performance, give them some feedback on, say, that explosion, just even a piece of that explosion or a low level, a low thing in real more near time, the faster they can get to the photo real look.
Welcome to Building the Open Metaverse, where technology experts discuss how the community is building the open metaverse together. Hosted by Patrick Cozy from Cesium and Mark Petit from Epic Games.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to our show, Building the Open Metaverse, the podcast where technologists share their insight on how the community is building the metaverse together. Hello, my name is Mark Petit from Epic Games, and my co-host is Patrick Cozy from Cesium. Patrick, how are you?
Hi, Mark. Doing great. Very happy to be back.
Are you looking forward to today's episode?
Oh, I can't wait to talk procedural.
Yeah, today we're going to be talking about content creation in the metaverse, and we have it in someone who is an expert in the domain. I don't know if you're going to call you a pioneer or a veteran, but please welcome Kim Davidson, the co-founder, president, and CEO of Side Effect Software. Kim, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Great to be here. Thank both of you for having me on.
Yeah, no, it's a pleasure. So you're a mathematician by trade, you know, from University of Waterloo. And you founded your company more than 35 years ago. Who knew the industry? Patrick, you didn't know the industry well at all, did you? So in 1987, you had the goal at the time of bringing 3D graphics to a wider audience. So there was an ambitious goal back in 87. It was originally known as Prism, and the software became Houdini in 1996. So during this journey, you and your colleagues at Side Effect collected 5 Technical Academy Awards, including 1 Oscar, the famous statuette. So congratulations for that. So please walk us through the creation of your company with your partner, Greg Hermanovic, back in 87, because that was the early days, right?
Yeah, sure. I'd sure love to. This could take the whole hour, but I'm trying to be brief because I love history because it gives us a window into the future. So, and which is what the metaverse is really something that we're all aiming for at the moment. So Greg, I'd have to go back to say 1983 where I first met Greg, and we both worked at a company in Toronto called HCR, and they had a successful growing business porting Unix operating system to mainframe computers and minis. Greg and I did work on some computer graphics projects, but it was very early days. But I'd say our real start, guys, was prior to Side Effects was when we left HCR and joined Omnibus Computer Graphics in Toronto in 1985. And to give you an idea, at Omnibus, that was the days of doing flying TV network logos, commercials, and there were only a handful of companies. They were about 75 people over 3 locations, Toronto, Los Angeles, New York. They did some work on Flight of the Navigator, so there was a little film work that was done out of LA. In Toronto, we're doing the flying logos. So these are definitely the early days of computer graphics for the media and entertainment industry. And we're working on mainframe computers, text terminals, 1 frame buffer, recording to 1-inch mag tape. I mean, this is all working blind, but it was a lot of fun. But there's no commercial software. This was out of universities where we're getting some code and some software out of the military. So we're basically, Greg and I and another team was there to write the software. And it was the president of Omnibus, John Penny, who actually named the software for one of the, they were a public company, so they had a stock exchange. So he for one of the annual reports, he named it PRISMS. And it was actually an acronym, which I like to say, and I wrote it down because it makes little sense. It should have procedural in there in my mind, but it's the production of realistic image scene mathematical simulation, and that's what PRISMS was. But there was no program called PRISMS. It was just really a collection of Unix programs that you could put together in a script. We'll talk about, it was really the roots of proceduralism right there in those putting those commands together. But we'll talk about that together later. But basically string these commands together, give them a bunch of arguments. And if the client wanted his logo bigger, thicker, more bevel, you just change a couple arguments, rerun the script, and out comes the geometry and out goes the renders and all that. So we're kind of a pretty... I don't know. I don't even think it was clever. It was just the Unix and C-shell way of doing work. leveraging the computer to its advantages. But in 1987, after Omnibus bought Digital Productions, which worked on The Last Starfighter and Robert Abel and Associates in LA, they went Omnibus. They were, as some people like to say, dead on arrival, Digital Omnibus Abel, DOA. But at that moment, for maybe a couple months, they were the largest company in the world doing this commercial animation. So in 1987, Greg and I are on the street, but we decided to put a bid into the receivers in bankruptcy for the exclusive right to the Prisms code. We got Prisms, we incorporated ZyneFX, and we just picked up where we left off, just the two of us. So albeit a much, much smaller company, but we knew how to do animations. I was the animation director. But I'd say, guys, beyond the code, really those 4 years of experience that Greg and I gained at HCR and Omnibus in the industry and using the software and writing it, that was the invaluable part of starting ZyneFX.
Yeah, that's a very unique founder's journey. Yeah, congrats on the success and what you've built today. So, Kim, usually for the podcast, you know, I'm the geek and Mark is the responsible adult. So I like to ask some of the geek and tech questions. So to start things off, you know, Houdini is super widely used for visual effects, and some of the best visual effects I've ever seen have been made with Houdini. I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about the tech and the procedural tech that's used.
Well, the tech is C++ code, but I don't think that's what you're asking. But if it's, you sort of mean architecture, then Houdini's like this flexible, full 3D animation system, and it's based on a procedural kind of architecture. That means, you know, everything from modeling to animation effects and compositing, you know, can be changed the way I was talking about that type, just that simple example of the type earlier. And anything, the other thing that's really, really key in the software, it didn't start as a CAD software. It started with time, like time, the fourth dimension, is very integral to the design. Anything that you want to animate can be animated. So they always had this procedural approach, Prisms and Houdini. So it's really built into the core of the system. And I think because we were animators in the early days, even when we started ZyneFX, I animated probably over 100 spots in the first year, just paying back the loans on buying the software. But because we're animators and programmers, I think we're like eating our own dog food, if they like. So we created an architecture, continued that architecture that we could change the director's, you know, whim and requests. So maybe I like to think programmers are lazy. They don't want to do anything twice, but it's certainly efficient. If you don't want to start from scratch, you know, so quick changes, experiments as well, you know, giving you a lot of varieties and variabilities for a director to pick from, if you want to show them to them at all, because often you don't want to give them too much choice either, but you have them in your back pocket. So anyway, I do want to say, though, it is a full 3D animation, but we're known a lot for the visual effects, and there's a reason for that, is because there was a lot of big companies in the mid-90s, you know, graphics cards, and were taking off, and companies were getting absorbed and bought. So we went to the one segment where we could really provide the biggest value with this proceduralism, and that was sort of the visual effects. And for that, those days, it was film in Hollywood primarily. So because visual effects then and now is where you really want to iterate to see what it's going to look like. It's a simulation. You have to sit back and kind of wait and see what that's going to look like. So that's where the proceduralism really kicks in.
And everything you're saying about the dog fooding and the fast iteration time is the same way we write code as well. So it's great. And speaking of the visual effects, I mean, what's next? What's on the roadmap?
Well, that's the cool thing about this industry, Patrick, as you know, there's always the next big thing, and there always will be, you know, sort of thing. Always has been. The one thing we're trying to do, you know, as we grow into these different segments and different parts of the pipeline, is just make the VFX, the visual effects, more accessible. So that's a lot of, you know, pre-built things, bringing, you know, more usability, more smarts to the whole program. So that's really one of the things. The other thing is really this leveraging our knowledge and effects for the doing more simulation for characters and character animators and artists. Maybe slightly further out. I mean, it's not a new topic. its own podcast. It's machine learning. We've done some experiments on our customers, but Houdini can push a lot of data, create a lot of data. So as an example, you wouldn't want to tweak a few parameters and run the explosion because it's like, oh, that doesn't look right. You have to retweak them. Why not let machine learning, you know, do thousands of iterations and see what that looks like? Because, you know, basically it can match a piece of video footage of an explosion that's already kind of to the director's liking. I think the other thing that I'll mention, one more thing that's next for everyone and certainly for Houdini and visual effects, is just more and more real time. We've been pushing photoreal is really, really important to, you know, the customer set we're going to, but if we can do stuff faster, performance, give them some feedback on, say, that explosion, just even a piece of that explosion or a low level, a low thing in real, more near time, the faster they can get to the photo real look. And the interesting thing is the game developers are coming from, they start with real time. And over the years, you know, as you've seen with the engines, photo real. So I think working with a game guys is really helping bring the best of those two worlds together. We're learning a lot from working with them, and they're, I think, upping their game on the photo reel as well.
I'm fascinated by the prospect of using machine learning to augment, you know, artistry, you know, to really support the artists. I'm glad to hear that you're doing experimentation. So are you optimistic that, you know, this can deliver on its promise of really, you know, taking a lot of the iteration of the cycle?
Oh, absolutely. Like we've done a test on machine learning. Sorry to cut you off there, Mark, on, you know, you just paint and you have Rocky Mountains, you paint and then using the machine learning just takes the Rocky Mountains and builds Rocky Mountains because it's already knows what red is and blue is and creates a realistic landscape. It's really quite cool. On Into the Spider-Verse, I think we have a case study on the website. They used a lot of machine learning for the inked lines. It was Houdini, but they set up the whole system and ran it through Houdini so the artists didn't have to paint as many ink lines on the CG characters to make it look a little more cartoony. The sky's the limit with that machine learning and AI, obviously, beyond that. That's, to me, a whole other level of intelligence. A lot of people say AI, they really mean machine learning, I think, in the two use cases I just talked about.
And even neural networks. I mean, we don't want to be overly technical, but we've seen this thing fall out of fashion, neural networks, and come back very, very rapidly in the content creation process. So, and it's very relevant because with the metaverse around the corner, the demand for 3D content and original 3D content would explode. So I'm sure these other technologies will help people like me with no artistic skills to actually create some of that content.
And Kim, do you think that procedural will reach every creator, right? Because we're seeing just, you know, everyone potentially becoming a creator with the metaverse.
Well, I think under the covers in some parts, you know, you want to speed something up. You make that part procedural and that part hard-coded or locked in and don't give a choice because, you know, that's not needed or not necessary or not for everyone. So definitely, you know, having a lot of stuff done on the fly can be very, very powerful. I mean, call it procedural, call it routines, scripted, whatever you want. But we kind of call it procedural because it is a recipe.
So let's come back on real time a little bit because, you know, we care about real time. We care about the metaverse. So, and I remember in 2013, we met in Toronto and you had launched the Houdini engine. And I mean, it was a little bit of a surprise to me that Houdini and games is a thought that had not crossed my mind back in the time. But since then, you really proved, you know, the value of your technology in the game development process and in real-time 3D. So, and I think, you know, we can say that, you know, Houdini has been used on some major AAA games now to help the process of creating those open worlds. So can you talk to us more about, you know, gaming and Houdini and how the proceduralism is helping those guys as well?
Yeah, thanks. That's a great memory, Mark. You know, we after the film visual effects, we did say we'd always had some customers in games. I mean, I think our second customer was, you know, in games in Japan. But after the visual effect, we consciously decided. But we always had this Houdini engine. I mean, it was used to run anything that was compute intensive in parallel in the background. Anything you could type in Houdini, you could make and run in a command in the background. So it's always been there. But I think when 2013 was where we were really starting to think about APIs and plugging it into other software and, you know, creating that that connection. And that really worked for, especially for the game people who didn't want to leave their package and jump back and forth, you know, save something out into an Alembic file, go back in, oh, that's not quite right. They just wanted to stay in the editor. So with Houdini and these, what we call Houdini assets, smart Houdini assets under the covers, you have the little interface presented that can create a tree or a bunch of trees or a bridge and a bunch of bridges. And they only have three or four controls, but it's really Houdini doing the recooking whenever you change one of those controls under the cover. So that's kind of the first place that, and the first place in games specifically was environments, because, you know, those are bigger problems, you know, than building a box or a car maybe, where you can buy a car and modify or build one car and never changes up to a spec. But environments, kind of something you just keeps going and growing. It's very organic. So that's where, you know, the Houdini engines, a lot of tools started building there. And so to give the listeners just a quick example, what does that really mean? So I'm sitting in the game editor, I'm building it, and I want to change a road, you know, 50 feet to the left. So you just move the curve that road is based on. You don't pick up all the geometry, you move the curve. The road gets recalculated, geometry for the road, the geometry for the guardrails, the geometry for lights, that's on all the rocks around. And literally, if there was a mountain in the way, you just move the mountain, literally, you know, if necessary. And then it's like, oh, let's gameplay that. Does that work for you now, Mr. Level Designer or Gameplay Designer? I'm showing my growth in the wrong industry. I'm trying to play games as much as I can, Mark, to keep in that space.
So you're the guy who moves mountain easily?
Yeah. And further, just to make it a little easier, we did create something called Houdini Labs about 4 years ago, and it's like there's so we could just iterate. So little tools to fix UVs or to poly-reduce. But poly-reducing isn't one command, you know? It's like five little commands that you want to tweak, but you just want to expose one or two things. So we created labs, and we contribute to that, and we invite other people to contribute to lab. They're on GitHub, but also on our website, where you can download these little tools that work with Houdini.
It makes sense. So you're making the process of creating those worlds, you know, much easier and almost fun, actually.
And we're looking, you know, stay close to your customer, right? That's really the trick in everything we do.
Yeah, and in terms of being nice to customers, you know, a year ago, I think it was in January 2021, you made the Houdini engine free. So what kind of impact has, you know, why do you take this decision and what kind of impact has it has for side effects?
Well, I don't think a lot of people understood, you know, what Houdini or Houdini engine in particular could do. We had these, you know, few licenses at every studio, but they weren't even being used that much. And they weren't expensive, but by making them free, we said, okay, and we did that at the start of the year last year, and we were saying, okay, well, let's have a goal of increasing it two to three times. And it ended up increasing the usage and installation over 10 times. So I'd say, to answer your question, it's going very well, and it's been well received, and more people are creating assets for use in the community. So I just think that's wonderful. I mean, we all working together. I got the engine, you help me with the tools, and I'll keep working on the engine. I don't know what things people need, because they're so changing and evolving. So having this platform called Houdini and Houdini Engine, I think, is really the key. So making it free was a big deal.
Kim, I admire the strategy, and I think for the metaverse, where, you know, all computing becomes so 3D centric that, you know, you need to get it out there, and you need that interoperability, as you said. You know, someone's building engines, someone's building tools, and everything works together in that ecosystem. So one thing I was very excited about earlier this year was the Matrix Awakenings demo for Unreal Engine 5. I mean, it's among the best real time I've ever seen, probably the best. We were lucky we had Kim from Epic, the other Kim, on the podcast a few episodes ago to tell us about the making of it. And I believe Houdini played a big role there, so I'd love for you to share us how Houdini was used.
Yeah, it played a role for sure. I'll let Kim Laverne say how big of a role, but and my CTO gave me a lot of tips on all the little nitty gritty technical details. But it was a positive experience for sure working with Kim and his team. We've known Kim at Epic Games before that. We worked with him at ILM and Digital Domain. But it was great working with him again on this project. And I'd say they did a lot of the heavy lifting. Our team was doing the Houdini engine updates and support, and we wrote like some new tools, the Pivot Painter tool to help with breaking glass. But largely it was creating that city based on a blueprint and raising that city up about the size of Los Angeles. I know Kim talks about that a lot. But that's a huge thing that obviously if you want to kind of re-change anything, you want to do that or build it just in time or whatever, and you want to do that in decorations. And a lot of that's happened. A lot of that mesh placement happens in Houdini, in the Unreal Engine, but Houdini is sort of like you can test all that stuff out, and there's a one-to-one mapping there, and then we just put a point cloud over, and then they instance the meshes onto those point clouds. So it's a real handshake. But remember, the Matrix Awakens was done in Unreal 5, and Kim talks about, it's a little green, it's new, but they wanted to push all the new features, and by doing that, they're also pushing, changing engine, and we're sort of like telling them what's wrong or what's right or what can work or what we can do with the Houdini engine. So there was a great partnership there back and forth between primarily our development team.
Yeah, and I think you need proceduralism. I mean, you can't manage by hand a model of the size of that city. So I think it was a great proving ground as well, as we expect to have, large scale open worlds in the metaverse that we're going to have to learn how to work at that scale where hand placement of things is not an option anymore. So it was indeed, I observed that. It was a great collaboration. I think it was a lot of learnings on both sides. And hopefully people will get this data set at some point. It will be released by Epic. Epic made that commitment. So it will be interesting for people to learn from that asset. And I think it shows the way of how we're going to have to manage content at scale. So.
Yeah, partnerships.
Kim, I also wanted to ask you about another project, Project Titan. Could you tell us the backstory on this?
Sure. Yeah. So what Titan is an in-house tech demo designed to production test, procedural workflows like we did on the Matrix while creating a 3D environment for Unreal Engine 5. So it's like the shoes on the other foot, right? We're now the people creating it, albeit much smaller, But we're getting support and feedback, and we're giving feedback to the Unreal 5 people over at Epic. So it's one thing to support them; it's another to do your own. Kind of like live it yourself. So we became the customer who brought us closer to what our customers are wanting to experience in real time by creating that IP. We create dozens of tools that we put out on the web, procedural assets. You can go to the website, SideEffectsTitan. We want to share that with community. We want to keep sharing that. And we did work with a few in-house, but we worked a lot with outside artists because that's how a lot of things are done these days. So we had artists that never touched Houdini. We build a tool for them and put them in the Unreal environment or put them in our environment or both. Depending on what they were doing. So that was a lot of good support and feedback to then put the, build the tools, but put them out. So we're going to continue with that. It's a live environment, it's an Unreal environment. We're already seeing some of the people use those tools to build their own environments. I won't call them worlds. That's what the metaverse needs, worlds. But this is everyone needs to start and somewhere. So, Titan to Independence to building on bigger teams and contributing to bigger and bigger teams. That's what's going to build this world.
Yeah, interesting segue because that's, that's what I think is fascinating about Houdini, and you know, also the work that you're doing with the Unreal Engine is kind of it's a window into the future, because we would want the metaverse is actually a lot about those, you know, large scale virtual worlds. Sometimes maybe most of the time realistic. So you talked about procedurism and smart assets already. What are going to be the key building blocks and the key technologies to build those, so that virtually anybody can build those virtual worlds? And you know, how do you see Houdini play a role in that landscape moving forward?
Yeah, well, it's a continuum, Mark. I mean, all the way from, you know, like letting kids have some Lego to having some more sophisticated content creators is, you know, sort of build those tools or use those tools in a really, really sophisticated and optimize those tools that aren't the developers of the tools, but the first users of the tools or the underlying users. So it's a continuum, I think, to build the worlds. It's going to take everyone, not just the people that are playing and sculpting the world and saying what they want, but also those that say, this building cannot be moved. This is, thank you, Santa, because I actually sold an NFT. So it's a big thing. But I think Houdini, really, we're behind the covers. We're largely helping those early content creators for these verses, whatever we want, world or worlds, creating large variety of assets that populate these worlds, you know, whether it's city, a forest, deserts, futuristic, fanciful, whatever you want to imagine, Houdini can, you know, help you like create that huge metaverse. That's what's needed, because the best metaverses, the ones that are going to be most immersive, are going to be the ones with the richest variety. So, you know, if you can build that, Patrick, you know, you're going to have more people, you know, live in your verse than Mark's metaverse, or vice versa. Maybe that should be a little challenge for your small little teams. But, you know, I just say we support those world creators and Houdini in turn. But whether it's Houdini or whatever, we want to, like, stay close to them and see where that metaverse is going, you know. And we don't just want to populate it with fences and trees. I mean, we have a lot of energy behind Houdini KinFX now, which is quickly advancing Houdini's character capabilities from motion capture, motion retargeting, all the crowd tools, which, you know, got a technical Emmy award, some physical correct motion, you know, based on weight and, you know, what a human body might do. So I did want to advance all that, because it needs creatures to really come alive. You need people inside those worlds too. But we're just supplying the foundation, the tools, and advancing those tools, guys, that I think is what's needed to create it. So we're very, very supportive of those world creators. And again, the more you can do, I think in the metaverse, the other thing Houdini might be able to do, like, I'm not sure, when you play a game, you go from region to region, that data gets unloaded, but it's still there. I mean, there's a piece of the disk that's keeping that data, and it's always there on the disk. But if you could just have the rules, which are so small, and use the compute power to recompute and build that data, you know, on a just, you know, as needed basis or just in time basis, that's where that procedural can play. Like, I'm all of a sudden, people are going to a part of the world that hasn't been explored for a long time. So it's like, okay, build it up. It's not sitting anywhere except for the rules to build that road, that part of the world. So I think that's where proceduralism and Houdini can play a part. I'm sure the engine providers are sort of think that way as they build the game or try to make the game smaller as well.
So Kim, you just touched on a geeky question I've been itching to ask, which is the trend, what the state now, then the trend of where the procedural execution is happening. You know, there's edit time and you bake out your geometry and textures. And then there's runtime, where you can end up with this really concise rule, but you need more edge compute. So are you seeing a trend that's more towards the later?
I think so. I really think so, because, you know, storage is compute, I think, going to be, the amount of storage that's needed is far going to outweigh the cost of that compute. And not for everything, maybe, you know, again, because obviously if I destroyed something, that world, and you want that to be persistent, There's no rule for that, really. You'd have to create a machine learning rule to recreate the destruction. So somehow differences to the rules have to be retained, for instance, in certain worlds. So I don't think it's for everything or every world, but I think we're going to see more like just build it up in real time. Or again, you know, if you know hints where the people are entering that world or going to need that world, then you run it in the background, get it all ready, and it's available.
So it's an interesting point, you know, that proceduralism. But, you know, a big theme about this podcast is about, you know, creating an open metaverse and making sure that those worlds, you know, there is interoperability. So how do we think about interoperability in the context of a procedural system? You know, do you think there, you know, we could define standards, share rules, you know, how do we, you know, because if things happen at runtime, how do we create an open world? Well, that is truly open. I'm losing my word. Something that's interoperable.
Right. I think you guys touched on that in a few other podcasts, if I remember. But it's like, do you have an engine here and an engine here? And somehow, you know, the right handoff has to be made. So there's probably people like you, Patrick, or others that I've heard that are better than I to figure out who's going to, like, have the rules. Because I think we want also, I think there will be several metaverses or worlds, if we can call the whole thing, but because that's how we get competition and advanced tech is if you start locking in too soon, you know one world can't advance, and so I like this little space race that could go on. But you're right, Mark, if you want to, like, just move in, we don't want an internet where, and I'll go back to the internet example for the listeners. It's like, you don't want to sort of have one kind of, like, control C means something here and menus pull down this way, and the other world, the world's got a whole different UI, different rules, different language. It look different, but we have to figure out how you can move fairly seamlessly from, in this case, web page to web page, but in this case, world to world. It's a challenge, but it will be, we all want that, so it'll come.
Absolutely. But you guys are a strong proponent of the open source and open formats at SideFX. You made a big investment on USD with Houdini. So how is it to work with an open source file format for a commercial software? How is interaction with Pixar, and how are things going on this front?
Yeah, no, that was almost serendipitous in some ways, because we have a long-term view of Houdini. So we're always updating pieces of the architecture. They're getting a little older, and this is several years ago. We were talking about a rewrite of all our lighting tools within Houdini, and we started talking to the Pixar people, and they had USD, obviously, is the backbone there, but they had a couple other users that go on. It wasn't, you know, it was just early days. So we jumped on the bandwagon after a bunch of meetings. We jumped on the bandwagon and said, let's make USD the heart. Like, it's really ingrained in the lighting tools. And we sort of learned, and it's, you imagine being an early adopter, it can be painful, but it also has the ability that you get to shape this thing, you know, along the way, whatever it is, and work with your customers to shape it as well, not just Pixar, but others who have got on there. And then a bonus really is we got layout and look dev and you know, interface with all the rendering tool up things, and we've rewritten our render to be USD. You know, centric, so it is Karma, and you know, that's just a wonderful thing for, you know, there, that alone, just having that Hydra render is really gets everyone into the same ballpark. So I think USD, and the best part of USD, of course, is the universal, because really, you know, Mark and Patrick, we're in a community that's like really embraces openness and standards and supports these things. And I saw a lot of, you know, like black boxes in that, and we never wanted that. And plus it's just philosophically, why am I recreating the wheel? A smaller company, it may be expensive, but it's just frustrating. So let's like all evolve these standards to the best that we can, and we'll create it, you know, for everyone, and USD is one of these newer standards. But yes, you were asked if it's being integrated. Yeah, absolutely, into more in the film pipelines than the games, but the games people are starting to figure out what parts of it are very useful for their needs.
So what about Material X? Is this something that you've been looking at and you think has the potential to also help us with sophisticated materials?
Yeah, we'll have support for Material X as well.
Kim, we covered a lot of ground today, procedural ground. Is there anything that we didn't cover that you're hoping we would?
Well, you know, the metaverse is like a billion questions, but what we could be talking about, but I should be talking about, I don't, you know, think there's any one that I would single out. But I guess maybe I would say, because I don't know if I've listened to all of them, but I do think it's a bit of a hype cycle right now. I mean, I'm a big believer seeing all these hype cycles when you've been around, but that doesn't make it less real, I guess it might say. It's, you know, we've been on this, and you have for before the hype started, and we'll be on it when it starts dying down. It is real, and I think that, you know, there are people that would say we're already there, you know, already some, you know, systems are already being social systems are already there, Roblox, that sort of thing. But I think within a decade, like, just caution everyone that this is, you know, early days, and but eventually we'll all be in this immersive experience, and you'll go, wow, so that's what they're talking about in that podcast, because it's a wow experience. It's to be in there, you know, to be with you guys, that's not a video, that is much better. When you've done that, that is much, much better. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, no, we agree. And I think we kind of consider that podcast as an antidote to the hype cycle, highlighting once it's been long in the making. I mean, you've been at it for 35 years, Kim. And, you know, the metaverse has its root in all of that CG technology. And that openness and that interop roadmap is probably a 10-year roadmap, you know, to get to the level of openness that we want. So it's been a long road, and it's a long road ahead. So, but yeah, we get to the moment right now. But it's, yeah. All right, so finally, is there a person, an organization, or an institution that you would like to give a shout out to?
I should shout out to the Academy Software Foundation that was formed a few years, and we were a founding member. But, you know, again, they have this neutral platform for open source developers in motion pictures and broader media. So I think that's just one example. There's other open sources and standards out there, but definitely we've, you know, really support and love those guys. And to my Side Effects team, past and present, I mean, that's my last shout out, because they're just wonderfully innovative. They're active in the industry, and they're supportive of the customers, and who are really the creators at the end of the day. And thanks to both of you. I mean, this series of podcasts, a great example of that, you're giving back and advancing in the industry. So shout out to you guys.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Kim. I knew you would be good at, because you've done so many Oscar acceptance speeches. So I knew you would be good at that question. So.
I'll wait for the transcript to go on to see how good. I'll reserve my judgment. But thank you, Mark.
No, it's been a pleasure, Patrick. Any last question? Any last word for today?
Kim, just really appreciate you sharing your knowledge and your perspective and your passion.
And very happy to cast a light on Houdini. It's a little bit of not a secret, but, you know, you've been behind every blockbuster movie and a lot of those games for the past many, many years. So you're one of those, you know, contributors, very, very strong and important contributor to the industry. So, Kim, it was a pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you.
And I want to thank the audience as well. You know, we get continued feedback, mostly positive. You know, people seem to enjoy, and our secret is to have, you know, good guests, because we just put a microphone in front of them and the content thinks so naturally. So, Kim, you've been one of those amazing guests. Thank you so much. Again, thanks to our audience. Reach out to us on social. Let us know how we're doing, what you want to hear about. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Patrick. And thank you, Kim.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks, everybody.